I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to all of you out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, with Front Row Classics of NPR Illinois Community Voices. And I am here with my co-host, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
Brandon, it's going really, really, really well. I'm really excited for what we've got coming up right after this intro.
Absolutely. We have a very special guest joining us this month. For most people, for those of you who don't know, I think a lot of our listeners probably do know, but November for a while now has been known as Noirvember, which is a celebration of all things film noir. And we had a very special guest join us today, and that is the czar of noir himself, Eddie Muller. And Eddie is an author, a film historian, and a host on Turner Classic Movies. He's the regular host of Noir Alley, which is a show that I rarely miss because I do love film noir. Eric, what are your thoughts on the interview that we're about to hear?
Well, so first of all, even though he calls himself the czar of noir, Eddie is a really humble guy, and he's doing a lot of work that we'll get to hear about to preserve a lot of films that other people wouldn't get to see otherwise. And he's an amazing wealth of knowledge on probably one of the and we'll get into a discussion on whether noir is a genre or not, but I feel like that's one of the things that draws people into classic movies are the noir films of the 40s and 50s. He's seen them all. He loves them. And we have a great discussion about all of them. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. He's a great raconteur. He's very approachable, and he bucks some myths about film noir that we ask him about, you know, and we just talk about the genre as a whole, and not just from the 40s and 50s, but into the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even into this century. So a great discussion here.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a couple of hidden gems that he's going to talk about in this one, and maybe some inside information on some things that are coming up in the future. So give it a listen.
Absolutely. And here right now, you will hear our interview with Eddie Muller. And here we are with Front Row Classics on NPR Illinois Community Voices. And we have with us as our very special guest today, Eddie Muller. How are you, Eddie?
I'm doing about as well as can be expected. I am breathing and I am virus free. So those are the two most important things right now.
That's about all we can ask for right now, I think. So I do have to say, though, I've been a TCM fan for a long time, and you all have just pulled off your intros and everything so seamlessly since this whole pandemic started. Was it strange recording from home in the beginning?
Yeah, it actually was very strange, largely because I really missed everybody that works on the show. TCM really is like a family. And I so look forward to going to the studio to do the introductions and hanging out with everybody. And it's such a professional crew that not having that was a real loss. And fortunately, I was able to put my old film school background to use. So I knew how to light my office and do stuff and make something passable out of it, but I'm very much looking forward to getting all this behind us.
Yeah, I think we all are, man. So, but yeah, how long have you been with TCM now?
I don't know, because in this pandemic, I can't tell time anymore.
Time has sort of become a fluctuating concept.
I mean, literally, we all thought we knew what take a day at a time meant before, but now it really is like, that's how I do it. And I guess the Summer of Darkness thing that I did with them, which was not, I was not officially a host, but they invited me to come in and host that. I think that was 2015.
Oh, okay.
But my actual communication with them and relationship with people at the network predates that by a number of years. But I guess I'm winding up my third season as the host of Noir Alley. So
great.
If you're talking about Noir Alley, then it's uh-huh. been 3 years, but I've actually been affiliated with TCM as a guest, let's say, for a lot longer than that.
Great.
Well, Eddie, would you be willing to take us back to what got you into film and specifically film noir?
Yeah, I think the bottom line here, Eric, is that I'm a storyteller. So when I go back to my childhood, I'm amazed to find like I would draw comic books, I would write stories. I was always very interested in communicating with people as a storyteller, right? And then of course I for many years I was a journalist, which is another form of storytelling. So that was really, it was inevitable that I would do something like that. It was always, I mean, at first I wanted to be a comic book artist and writer and then a filmmaker. And then I had to pay the bills, which I did as a reporter and a journalist for a number of years. And then I wanted to be a novelist, which I did. And then lo and behold, out of all of that grew this this cottage industry, I guess we'll call it, around film noir. And that was because I wrote my first book on the subject, Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir. And I was invited to program a film festival based on that book. And that pretty much cast the die there, you know. And then when I realized there were movies I wanted to show that there were no longer prints of those films, that's when I created the Film Noir Foundation so that we could raise money to restore stuff. And it was just like a natural progression. And then, like I say, I was a guest with TCM a number of times, specifically for noir related things. And then it just felt very organic that at some point they said, why don't you come on and just do a regular show? So that's the story of how all of that happened. I can say that it's all been a progression based on passion and not based on financial remuneration. because until I got this regular gig at TCM, there was nothing steady about the inflow of money supporting my passion, right? So thank you, TCM.
Do you remember when you first saw something and you sort of identified it as film noir, and when that sort of sparked that passion, though? Was there a time when you saw a particular movie or read a particular novel and said, I like this, I need more of this in my life, I need this to be the way I tell stories and see stories?
Yes, it all happened in my early teens. And I'm glad you mentioned read something, because to me, it was a double-barreled thing. It was the movies and the books, right? Mm-hmm. So I remember distinctly, I would watch Dialing for Dollars on the local affiliate out here, KTVU TV in Oakland, California, and I would see a lot of the older films that are now, you know, I'd watch them on TCM now, but TCM didn't exist back in the dark ages of the early 1970s when I was watching this stuff. Yes, and it was I didn't know it was film noir, but it resonated with me, and I knew these were movies I liked, like Thieves Highway and The Big Heat and Night in the City and stuff like that. And then I started reading stories. I started reading the Dashiell Hammett stories. I saw Chinatown the day it came out. And Chinatown definitely, it's like connect the dots, mm-hmm. right? And then Chinatown, when people started referring to it as a Raymond Chandler type thing, then I read the Chandler books. And like so many people, they were a colossal inspiration to me. I think Chandler has probably inspired more people to become mystery writers than any other writer ever. Hmm. And it's just the beauty of the language and the worldview that kind of seeps out of those books was very formulative for me.
It's interesting. I do find in those kind of stories, even though it's kind of a darker world, there is kind of a comfort in noir stories almost. You can almost sort of kick back and just let your mind go almost.
Absolutely. I mean, I always describe them as like the Hollywood's anti-myth. Uh-huh. I mean, the myth of Hollywood is happily ever after. You know, it's going to work out, right? And noir is the exact opposite. You know, it's the flip side of that coin. Like, no, it's not. You may think it is, but it's not. Trust me, it's not going to work out. But you know, it's interesting because when it comes to noir, there is no one thing. It's not set in stone, even what it is or what it's supposed to feel like. So I totally understand what you're saying. And to me, it's very interesting that at the time these movies were made, in the late 40s and early 50s primarily, a lot of people watched these films and saw them as a threat, because they were saying things about our culture and about the society that was very scary. People didn't want to believe that we were as corrupt as these movies show us to be. Recently, when people come to my festivals or write me after they've watched Noir Alley, it's evident that people treat these movies like comfort food. Mm-hmm. Like they go back to them because, oh, I love that world. I feel safe in that world. It speaks to me, you know. And it's almost like the point is, you know, the thrust of these things thematically is almost beside the point for some people. Mm-hmm. They love the feel of it. And I get it. It's both things. I've said, you know, some of these movies were just firecrackers that were like little diversions, and some of them were like bombs.
Yeah.
You know, just dropped on the culture. And it's all of those things.
Yeah.
Right? It is all of those.
Yeah. You mentioned the wide brush that noir covers. So would you consider it like a genre, like you would a Western or a musical, or is it bigger than that?
It was an organic artistic movement, uh-huh. that really was most compatible with crime movies.
Right.
But as a movement, it was so influential that it seeped over into other genres at that time. So you could see what I call noir stained Westerns, noir stained war movies. I mean, even like the Doris Day picture, the mid-50s Doris Day picture, Love Me or Leave Me, it's a Technicolor spectacle with Doris Day and a lot of musical numbers, but at its core, that's a very, very noir movie, right? About a woman being manipulated by a gangster and struggling to find her freedom. And all. I mean, it's a timeless tale and it's very appropriate for today, but I consider that a subset of Doris Day noir.
I watched Leave Her to Heaven recently, and I, you know, there's some beautiful Technicolor in that movie, but that's noir if I ever saw it.
To the core.
Yeah.
That is noir to the core.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but for your taste, Eddie, then what are sort of the elements that you would say throw something more solidly into the noir category? What are some of the must-haves that you've got to have?
Well, the thing, I come to this whole thing as a writer, so I tend to look at everything from the writer's standpoint. So I'm very interested in the protagonists of these stories. And generally, to me, a noir story is, and I hesitate to use the word villain, where the villain is the protagonist of the story, because what these movies are telling us is that there's this moral complexity and that people do things for very different reasons, you know. But if you look at the movie Double Indemnity, that I consider like the ultimate noir film, the definitive noir film, I mean, it's about a protagonist who, it's hard to actually say what his motivation is, because does he really fall for this woman, or does he, is he using the woman to try to game the system to commit the perfect murder because he doesn't believe in his father figure's view of the world, right? I mean, that's what happens in that movie. And to me, that is incredibly noir, that that's the protagonist of the film. That's the guy that the audience is supposed to empathize with, right? Mm-hmm. That makes something noir to me. Whether it's in color, whether it was made in 2006 or 1946, if that's the type of story you're watching, I consider it to be noir, in the black and white and the color. But I get it. I get that it, as an organic artistic movement, yeah, it kind of started in the early 40s and it kind of petered out toward the end of the 1950s. And it's black and white and everybody loves the way it looks, you know, the wisecracking slang. I get all of that, and that's why people are drawn to it and why people love it. As the quote-unquote expert on the subject, I have my own more hardcore definition. But, you know, guys, my job is to get people in the tent to watch these movies. Sure. I mean, everything I do is aimed at the younger generation. Because I don't want people to think these movies are no longer relevant or that there's no reason to watch them. So I try to make them come alive as much as possible for a younger audience. And that's what I do. And so I don't apply my hardcore guidelines, because to me that's being exclusive instead of inclusive. You know, sometimes I get grief from people who say, oh, you know, he's showing another movie that isn't film noir. And it's like, well, how do you know unless you look at the other movies that are like a hardcore film noir, and then you get to determine why you don't think it is, right?
All right.
Yeah. This is, and the other thing in that regard that's so important that people need to understand is the debate about what is or isn't film noir is largely why it's still so relevant, right? I mean, how many other quote unquote genres do you get to argue about is it or is it? Is it a Western or isn't it, Eddie? Well, we know if it's a Western, right? Right. Is it a musical or isn't it? But only noir do people actually have that argument. And that's good. I think that's really good. It makes people think.
Yeah, I love your little noir or not videos on YouTube. I think that's great. And, you know, there are many times where, you know, I hear Casablanca referred to as noir, and you clear that up perfectly, that, you know, it's it's got elements, but it's certainly not film noir.
No, that's a romantic adventure melodrama. If Bogart, if Bogart, you know, died at the end or killed somebody or you know, so if he killed, you know, Laszlo Kovacs, you know, yeah. Paul Henry to be with Ilsa, and then it didn't work, that would be noir, right? And then he's left alone and goes to prison.
Yeah.
That would be a film noir.
I think you maybe just gave Hollywood an idea for Casablanca 2.
Yeah, so. I was just thinking, I sense remake.
Yeah. Oh, please no.
No. Never.
When you go back though to where the spark for film noir started, does it start with The Maltese Falcon? Is that the movie that really everyone can point to?
You mean in general, not for
in general,
me.
In general.
No, I think it actually predates that, but,
okay.
But honestly, for the sake of convenience, the Maltese Falcon is a point of convergence where everything sort of happened at once in the timeline, because it incorporates, see, noir really grew out of the 1930s. It was the anxiety and the fear that people felt from the Depression that really informed the stories that are the basis for noir. So when you read Hammett or when you read James M. Cain's novels, Double Indemnity, Postman Always Rings Twice, those are Depression era novels. And the things that are torturing people in those books have everything to do with the economic collapse of the country and all of that stuff. But because it took John Huston and Bogart to do the Maltese Falcon right, and it wasn't until 1941 that it came out, that it falls into another era of filmmaking, and it just happens to be the earliest example of 40s crime movies. If you really look at the Maltese Falcon, it doesn't look that much like film noir. It doesn't have the look of later films that we associate with the movement. But because of Hammett's influence on it, because of Bogart's influence on it, and which I don't think can be overstated, that his attitude that he brought to the screen as an actor is a huge part of what kickstarted the noir movement, because he's not a hero. He's just a guy out to do his job and protect himself. And he has his own set of ethics that, you know, he's not a lawman. He's a guy who knows how to play both sides of the fence. And that whole very cynical, world-weary attitude that was Hammett's, Bogart conveys that brilliantly on screen. And I think that had a lot to do with popularizing, you know, why The Falcon was a big hit, where the other movies were not, because there were two versions of it previously made at Warner Brothers. And then the influx of European emigres who sort of changed the look of movies in Hollywood had a lot to do with just doing something new and exciting that everybody wanted to jump on that bandwagon, right? So every studio yeah. started doing them. You know, every cinematographer was like, oh good, I get to do my noir now. You know, and that suffused all of the crafts, right? I mean, the art directors, the costume designers, the cinematographers, the directors, and the actors and actresses especially all wanted to go dark,
right?
And play the other side of the coin for a change. And that's why you got a movement out of it.
Yeah.
And you've given us some really good examples of some movies that sort of toe the line between noir and maybe some other categories. And we know, too, we did a little bit of research and saw on your website that you've got your list of the 25 greatest noir films. But is there one out there for our listeners that flies under the radar? And I'm putting you on the spot here. Is there one that most people don't know about that you would point out and say, that's a great noir film that somebody should check out?
Sure. And I just want to clarify that, boy, I should have learned my lesson about the internet a long time ago. Because when I put that thing on my website, it must be 12 or 15 years ago now, mm-hmm. I said, these are the 25 noir films that I think will stand the test of time. And everybody shortens it to Eddie's picks for the greatest noir films.
I just did that. I apologize. Yeah.
No. It's okay. I say it was my mistake. I should have made two separate lists or something, you know, because people really want to hold me to account for that. But to answer your question, I always say to people, look, if you don't know anything and you want to get a quick grasp of what noir is, you want to watch Double Indemnity or Out of the Past. Those are the two films that nail it. The one that flies under the radar for people who maybe, oh, you know, I like this, but I haven't seen everything, The movie I recommend is Crisscross, the Robert Siadmak directed film with Burt Lancaster and Yvonne DiCarlo and Dan Duryea. Crisscross is one of my all-time favorite films. Not quite as well known as, you know, Double Indemnity and The Big Sleep and The Third Man and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That is certainly one. I mean, there's all of the films that I have restored through our Film Noir Foundation, like The Prowler and Cry Danger and Try and Get Me and Woman on the Run. Too Late for Tears is one that actually was completely lost until we actually were able to restore that film. That film was like the Holy Grail. It just disappeared because it was an independently made film and it had no protection from a major studio. And, you know, it's an Elizabeth Scott movie with Dan Duryea and Arthur Kennedy. So stars of their time, but they're not Humphrey Bogart or something like that. So it definitely flies under the radar. And that's a hugely entertaining movie that's just full of double crosses. Too Late for Tears is one of those movies like we were referring to before that even though it's about people doing horrible things and killing each other and betraying each other, it feels very comfortable and very enjoyable because you can't really take it seriously. So it's just fun watching people behave badly.
Yeah. I tell you what movie I came across recently, and I was shocked I hadn't seen it sooner, but In a Lonely Place just floored me when I saw it for the first time.
It's my favorite movie of all time.
Is it? Is yeah. It? Bogart is fantastic.
That's his performance. That's the most self-revelatory performance of Bogart's career, because he's playing himself by and large.
Yeah.
And I think the Nick Ray really felt, the director really felt, you know, that he was telling his own story as well. Self-destructive men. That's a big aspect of the noir genre. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And that movie sort of nails it in a very adult and intimate way, because there's no gunplay. There's a murder, but it doesn't happen to a major character in the movie. By the way, I knew that woman. And it's interesting, the woman who is the murder victim in A Lonely Place, the hat check girl who comes home to his apartment, her name, believe it or not, was Martha Stewart. That's the actress's name. And she was a doll. And I did a couple of interviews with her along with screenings of the film where she talked about making that movie. And she was exactly like the character in the movie. Even though she was like almost 80 years old when I interviewed her, she had that same naive, ingenuous quality, mm-hmm. you know, where she just wanted to please you. And it's like, I hope this is the answer that you wanted or expected. And it was like, man, this is incredible. This woman, they cast her perfectly.
is there somebody that you've gotten to meet or you've gotten to interview from the film noir world that, you know, has been your favorite person to meet, that lived up to your expectations the most?
Well, the one that was they've all been great. I mean, I have to tell you, there isn't a person that I have interviewed that I've come away saying, what a loser. Well, yeah, there's one. There is one. But I need not say it because everybody else has said it as well. So it doesn't have to be said. But I did a book called Dark City Dames about six actresses who are synonymous with film noir, and they were all wonderful. And we became very good friends, and I'm sad because that was six funerals I really didn't want to attend, and that's happened, you know. But the person who surprised me the most was Ricardo Montalban.
Wow.
Because he didn't make a lot of noir. He made like two, Border Incident and Mystery Street, right? And a few others in which he's a supporting character. But he was just a magnificent interview. And a wonderful man. And he came out to do it even though he had the worst back problem I've ever seen. I have a bad back. mm-hmm. and watching him, it took him like 5 or 6 minutes to get from his seat up to the stage because he moved so slowly. And yet he had this regal quality about him. And I really admired that guy. And he was very, boy, too bad he didn't live a little longer. I would have loved to have seen his reaction to current events because he was defiantly Mexican.
Oh, wow.
And he made a point of saying, Hollywood never let me play what I am, which is a Mexican. Oh. They made me play a Cuban, a Venezuelan, everything but what I am, which is Mexican, proudly, you know. And
yeah.
He was really a beautiful guy.
Fantastic.
Well, it seems like, and I think you've mentioned this already, that noir films and projects seem to bubble up over time too. So they're not just a product of the 40s and the 50s. Are there some things that you can think of in more modern history, the last 25 years or so, that you'd look at and say, well, that stands up even with some of those 40s and 50s films and books?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, I've lost track of time, so it's very, very hard. It's very weird for me to categorize noir as classic noir and neo-noir,
mm-hmm.
because look at it this way. Between the time The Maltese Falcon was made and Chinatown was made, right, was like 33 years between those two films, right?
Mm-hmm.
How long ago was Chinatown made?
Wow.
Yeah, in 1973. Yeah. So it's coming up on like a 50th
That's crazy.
Anniversary pretty soon. So it's very hard for me to just see the classic era as this thing that happened in like a 20-year period. And then everything else is a new modern film, you know? So yeah, Chinatown to me is an all-time classic. And if anybody, if it was shown, when it is shown on Turner Classic Movies and somebody says, why are you showing new movies? It's like this movie is almost 50 years old and yeah. it is every bit as good, if not better, than any movie, any detective story made in the classic era. So yeah, I don't see a distinction anymore. I get it from a scholar's point of view. I understand the timelines people use, but for me as a guy who's a writer and a, you know, sometimes artists who tell, you know, writes novels and things. I don't get what the distinction is in these time frames. And if you talk to young filmmakers today, if you talk to Joel and Ethan Coen, if you talk to Chris Nolan, David Lynch, you know, Martin Scorsese, any of these people will bend your ear about their love of film noir and how much it inspired them when they were young. Even people who don't make films like that. All those guys are examples of, they've made a noir film, all of
mm-hmm.
them. But somebody like Alexander Payne, who I talk to all the time, and he's a total noir junkie. He loves these movies. He's never made one, but believe me, they have inspired him. And I always say that the reason young filmmakers gravitate toward noir is because you don't need much to do it. Right, you lock a man and a woman in a hotel room with a gun in the drawer, and it's noir. I mean, that's it. So you can make that movie. You don't need a huge budget or anything. And so many filmmakers cut their teeth on these kinds of films because they're manageable, just like they were back in the 40s when studios would, you know, a lot of noir came out of the B units. Where they didn't have money, they didn't have time, they didn't have the top level stars. You know, it's a mistake to think that noir, that's what noir is. It's B movies, because it's not at all.
Right.
I mean, Double Indemnity is as A as it gets, right?
Uh-huh.
But yeah, they're minimalist. That's something that's very important about noir, because they're about people who exist in the margins. They are, by their very nature, kind of minimalist. There's no big budget cast of thousands noir film. Sure. That doesn't exist.
Rian Johnson did a very successful noir in a high school with Brick.
Excellent example. Yeah. Excellent example. Yeah, that was a modern Maltese Falcon.
Was.
I mean, there are distinct references to the Maltese Falcon throughout. I loved Richard Roundtree in that movie, because when he calls Joseph Gordon-Levitt into his office, like he's one of the cops in the Maltese Falcon, he's like playing the Ward Bond or the Barton McClane character. And he says, if you don't shape up, I'm going to see you at the parent-teacher conference.
That was fantastic. Yeah, but going back to the, you know, sort of golden age classic era of noir, was it World War II ending that really, you know, did it sort of finally give these filmmakers permission to explore these stories now? Because I feel like during World War II, it was really everyone's mission to keep morale up. But now that things were sort of back to normalcy, it gave them that freedom?
I think you can make that argument, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think that artists, you know, the rise of recently the Renaissance, if you will, in pre-code cinema.
Yeah.
People discovering pre-code cinema shows that noir could very well have happened sooner, right? Because a lot of those movies and those stories are very dark, very adult, very sophisticated. I'm thinking of pictures like Beast of the City or OK America or, you know, Laughter in Hell, stuff like this. Safe in Hell is another one. A lot of hell movies, you know, 2 Seconds with Edward G. Robinson. These are all kind of very noir films. But there was all this, artists are contrarians by nature, right? Mm-hmm. So writers, if you tell them this is how you have to write it, a certain percentage of them are going to want to write it the other way, right? And that's just the way artists are. So here you had the Depression, write stories that make people feel good. And then you had World War II, write stories that say it's all going to be okay. And then the war's over and it's like, thank God, now we can finally write stuff that's just a story. You know, and one thing that I've discovered is, you know, when you read the scholarly theses about these movies, they will tell you that there's a political motivation to everything. And while that is true in the case of some filmmakers, in the case of other filmmakers, it's just like, I've told these other stories already. Now I want to tell this one that I was never allowed to tell before. So that's where you're right, Brandon. It's sort of like, now we've fought to save freedom for the world. And one of those freedoms is we can now tell the stories that we want to tell. It didn't last for long, I have to tell you. because so many of them wanted to tell the same kind of story that it got scary. Mm-hmm. And theater exhibitors said, enough of this stuff, you know? And that sort of dovetailed with the Blacklist and the whole anti-communist witch hunt, where it was like, well, let's root out some of these people really seem to hate America. So let's root them out, you know? And all they were doing was just telling a different story, right?
Absolutely.
It wasn't like they hated America. It was just like, well, we've heard that one a million times. Let's do this one now. And it cost them. In some cases, it cost them.
Yeah. Was there one studio at that time that you feel did noir best, that seemed to crank out the best examples of noir?
Well, a couple stand out. I mean, there are some surprises in that regard. I mean, I want to say Warner Brothers, because Warner Brothers during the Depression was making the tough, socially conscious movies, especially when Daryl Zanuck was head of production there. Mm-hmm. But RKO, before the takeover by Howard Hughes, I always call it the House of Noir. Because they understood that the stories didn't cost a lot to make. It fit with their production philosophy. Don't spend a lot of money. Tell interesting stories. They weren't MGM, in other words. They weren't going to break the bank, and they didn't need big stars and all that stuff. So MGM was the anti-noir studio.
Right.
Even if they would go on to make The Asphalt Jungle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But a studio like Paramount, it's kind of surprising that you wouldn't think that. But then when you look at it, they did This Gun for Hire in 1942, The Glass Key in 1942, Double Indemnity in 1944. Those are three major significant titles in the earliest part of the film noir movement, and they were all made at Paramount. So that's kind of surprising. And Fox certainly did their share of noir films, as did Universal. I mean, everybody got in the act. MGM was the one that was vociferously opposed to it because Louis B. Mayer hated that stuff.
Yeah.
But then Dori Sherry came over to take over production from RKO. And that's when you saw pictures like Border Incident and Asphalt Jungle and Scene of the Crime and stuff like that start getting made at MGM.
Wow.
So what can we expect to see coming up on TCM and your program and what else from you?
On TCM, I'm just going to do what I do, you know.
Great. Keep doing it.
We're booking the 2021 season on Noir Alley right now. There will be some surprises. I hope people make that trip with me because we might just leave the United States for a few films.
Excellent.
And we are in the midst of doing a Noir City International Film Festival that runs through the 29th of November, and that is entirely online. You know, I do 8 film festivals around the country every year through the foundation, and they're called Noir City as opposed to Noir Alley. And we're doing a program of 19 movies now that people can stream online that has been hugely successful. I was really trepidatious going into this. I didn't know what to expect, and our partners at the AFI Silver Theater have said, you know, the advanced ticket sales passes, meaning people committing to watch all 19 movies, have exceeded any festival they've ever staged.
Wow.
Online or live. Wow. So that's absolutely fantastic. So I have all that stuff going on, and I'm looking into what the world is going to look like in 2021. Like, if we get a vaccine and if we're able to go back to normal life, I mean, I'll go back to a movie theater right after I go back to the bar. that is just killing me. It is killing me that we can't go to the bars right now. And then in July of next year, Running Press is reissuing my original film noir book, Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir.
Great.
In a revised and expanded edition. So the intervening, what I've learned in the intervening 20 years will now be in that book, which will be reissued in a fabulous deluxe hardcover edition that I am very excited about.
Fantastic.
Fantastic. We'll have to have you back to talk about that.
Sign me up. I'll do that. I'll do that.
Eddie, I got a hard-hitting question here for you, too. So when the bars open back up, one of our listeners or viewers bumps into you at the bar, what do they need to buy you? What's the drink of choice?
Oh, well, actually, they can't. The bartender cannot make a martini better than I do. So I don't actually order that too often in bars. So I'm going to generally, when I go into a bar, I watch the bartender. And if I feel this person really knows what they're doing, I will say, what's your favorite drink? and then I'll drink what they make, because then I learn something. I hope it's something I don't know, right? If they don't know what they're doing, then I order bourbon neat.
Tough to mess that up.
It's tough to mess that up. Yeah.
Now, one thing with the Noir City festivals, when you know the world is normal, do you usually do that in multiple cities?
Yes, we do it in San Francisco, Hollywood, Seattle, Austin, Texas, Chicago, Detroit, Boston, Silver Spring, Maryland, which we call Noir City, D.C., but it's actually Silver Spring, Maryland. And then I've done a lot of shows overseas as well in Europe. And I'm looking forward to doing that next year as well. I have a standing invitation to go to Paris and do a Noir City show.
Great.
In Paris, which I've done one, a really extensive one at the Cinémathèque Française, which was 40 films, and it lasted a month.
Wow.
There are worse gigs than spending a month in Paris, presenting classic films to a really, really appreciative audience. The French are just totally gung-ho about movies. And it was a trip to, because when I did that, it's a normal size theater. It's a Cinémathèque. It's not like a big movie palace or anything. Mm-hmm. So there's probably 300 people in the auditorium. And I'm introducing the movie in English. Most of the people are bilingual, but I had great translators. Sometimes I had like great French directors come in to translate for, like, Bertrand Tavernier was always there and always willing to translate for me. And it's like, wow, this is deluxe. But you'd look out in the audience and it's like, I recognize there's like actors and actresses and filmmakers that I recognize in the audience. And they come to watch movies and nobody bugs them. It's not like, when I do the shows in Hollywood, I sometimes get, Alexander Payne will come out, or Quentin Tarantino comes to the shows when it's a movie he hasn't seen before. And everybody, it's like big deal and everybody wants to bug him and he's got to sneak out the side door. It's amazing. In France, it's like Monica Bellucci comes to a movie and people just leave her alone.
Wow.
They'll nod or something. it's very civilized.
Yeah. I tell you, I love the convenience of watching movies at home, but I miss that shared experience in a theater. So there's nothing like it.
Well, I totally agree. It's been a huge part of our success. The Film Noir Foundation's success has been in presenting that communal experience where people, it's actually a gathering place for like-minded people, and they love people because it's a 40s thing. They love to dress in their vintage clothes and have a place to show it off where they're not considered the weirdo, because everybody's dressed like that.
Yeah.
It's great. And I always, when I would do this, I started out saying we got to restore and preserve the movies. And then I realized, wow, that's not all, but we're preserving the movie going experience.
Yeah.
Like seeing, and then it was very important that we try to do these in venues that had that feel of a classic movie. I don't want to always say palace, but the Castro Theater, where we do it in San Francisco, is certainly a movie palace. But then, as I said earlier, guys, my job is to preserve the audience. To make sure that younger people keep coming to these movies. And, that's what I'm all about. It's just vitally important. And when those younger people come to the show, they sometimes have to learn proper movie etiquette.
Yes.
Don't talk during the movie. Don't look at your phone. And I'm kind of a stern taskmaster without being, unpleasant about it. But, I'll say, if you take the phone out, trust me, this audience, they're going to let you know. And you don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be that guy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Eddie, we do not want to take up any much more of your time, but we thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a real treat.
It has been a pleasure, guys. It was great fun talking to you, and I'm taking you up on your invitation to come back when the book comes out.
Thank you very much.
Pub date is July 6th.
Keep doing the – oh, sorry, I tromped on that. What was the date that's coming out?
Pub date is July 6th.
July 6th. Wonderful.
Very nice. And if – and next time Noir City is in Chicago, I will take the train up.
Fantastic. please do. And of course, introduce yourself. And I'm hoping we'll be back there in 2021.
Awesome. And Eddie, is there any social media where anybody can find you or contact you?
Yeah, I mean, they can always find me through like the Noir Alley Facebook page or the Twitter feed or something like that. I mean, I have my own accounts, but I really steered clear of social media during this quote unquote season, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And I got to tell you, it was very refreshing.
I bet.
So, and also, obviously, we want people to go to Film Noir Foundation, all one word run together, filmnoirfoundation.org, because that's the home of the nonprofit foundation that I run that you know, actually does the work of finding and restoring and preserving these films. So that is near and dear. I'm really thrilled to say that even though we've been out of theaters since March, online donations to the foundation have exceeded previous years because people are just being so kind and so generous, knowing that we don't have the festivals to raise money. The message is getting through because we're not stopping the work. You know, we have another restoration in the works that will come out next year.
Great.
So that's been very, very gratifying.
Awesome.
As it has been being with you guys, I greatly appreciate the invitation.
Oh, thank you so much. And yeah, we will be in touch definitely. And we'd love to have you on again.
Awesome. Your wish is my command.
Thanks, Eddie.
Thank you, Eddie.
All right. Thank you very much.
Man, Eric, that was quite an interview. He's a great guest, and I am excited that he's willing to come on again.
Absolutely. One of the best things that came out of that too was the fact that they are preserving films. And right at the end of the interview, he gave the website for the Noir Film Foundation. If you got a mind to go and show them some support so that these noir films can continue to live on.
And we will, in our NPR posting and everything, I'll make sure to include the website for the Film Noir Foundation as well as Noir City, so that if you're interested in going to a film festival once we're able to again, and I know a lot of us can't wait until we can do that again, you can find the dates and the locations for that. But yeah, just a great interview, and I'm so glad that we were able to talk to him. And we've still got one more show coming up here at the end of the month. Eric, do you want to tell people about that?
Yes. Well, it came out of a poll that we put up on Facebook because we wanted to have our own little Noir-vember here, and we asked our listeners to vote on which noir film they wanted us to discuss. And the winner, by a decent margin, I believe, was The Big Sleep. So we're going to discuss that here and put that out in the month of November. And so look for that. And if you're not following us on Facebook, do that, and you can interact with us there and look for polls just like that in the future.
Yeah. And so it'll be a fun episode. It should come out fairly soon, I would say close to Thanksgiving, because, you know, we want to be thankful for the film noir genre.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so Big Sleep, a great film, written by somebody who we know Eddie loves, Raymond Chandler, from the original novel.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, you just heard it. He said he's probably the reason that most people become mystery writers, which is really an amazing thing.
Yeah, so a lot to look forward to. And then also coming up in December, we're going to go the comedy route. We've talked about some heavy stuff here the last couple months, so it's time to lighten things up a little bit. We're going to be talking about the comedy from 1958, Anti-Mame. Brett Rutherford will be joining us for that. And then Jeremy, our editor-in-chief, who hasn't been on in a while, but will join us again for The Great Race from 1965 with Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, and Natalie Woods. So that'll be a lot of fun as well. So still plenty of stuff to keep you satisfied during quarantine here for the rest of 2020 and to keep things merry during your holiday season. So
absolutely.
As always, you can find us, as Eric mentioned, on Facebook. You can also find us on Instagram, and also find our Front Row Network Patreon page. If you enjoy what we're doing and want to be a continued supporter, please consider making a donation there. So that wraps it up for another episode of Front Row Classics. And for Front Row Classics, I am Brandon Davis.
And I'm Eric Flick.
And we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.